Back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is Thursday, October 4th, 2012. My name is Ben Stone, and this is podcast number 210. Now, as you might be aware, this is the first new podcast in all around 2 weeks, I suppose. We've had some family issues, and my wife and I had to go out of town. We had to travel to eastern Ohio and eastern Kentucky, where my father was hospitalized for a heart problem. He came real close to checking out. And they were able to get him into the hospital, and they removed about 600 milliliters of fluid from around his heart. They discovered that roughly half or a little bit more than half of his heart was dead. Actually, you know, just dead tissue. He's got a clot in his heart that's a little bit smaller than a golf ball. Now, normally all these things would cause a person to, the doctors almost immediately start talking about open heart surgery in a case like this. But my father made the decision, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to crack this chest open and dig around in it, and then expect almost 90-year-old man to, you know, rehabilitate and come back out of such surgery. So he just basically told him, no, we're not going to go that way. So instead, to try to keep the heart fed a little bit better and so forth, they ended up putting in three stents into his arteries that actually feed the, or veins or whatever, that actually feed the heart. So the heart will get more blood to do the work that it's supposed to do. Now, so we finally came back home. He's going to go into a rehabilitation facility for a while. Hopefully it won't be long term. Hopefully it'll be a few weeks or something. He can get back on his feet and live independently again. I know that's his goal. Although, you know, the funny old guy, my sister was telling me when they took him down to the rest home, or actually it's kind of a combination of rehab facility and rest home and whatever politically correct terminology you want to use to make a person feel better about being shoved into a place like that. He wasn't too happy about going down there, but he's still having some trouble getting around and everything, so they convinced him it would be good for him temporarily. And then they got him down there, and the nurses wheeled him into the cafeteria, and it was basically a big social gathering of all these other old people. And my dad has such a dynamic personality. He just immediately had a crowd of elderly ladies and gentlemen around him, listening to his stories and telling his tales, and he was just, you know, he was just eating it up. So it may be, who knows, it may be that he adapts to living in that kind of situation, and he may be able to tolerate it and stick with it. But we'll see. So for a couple weeks there, my wife and I jumped in the motorhome, went off into eastern Kentucky and eastern Ohio, camped out at a wonderful campground back there, and we really got reminded of how small our motorhome is. It served me very well when I took it to Pork Fest. I was in it by myself, and the motorhome has served us very well in emergency situations with my wife's family when we had to go and use it. Sometimes even we stayed in it in the hard part of the winter one year. We stayed in it quite a bit, and the motorhome serves very well, but it's very old, and it's starting to get to an age where We need to think about, you know, that it's going to start costing a lot of money to keep it running. And we saw that with Porkfest. We ended up putting a lot of money into the motorhome before I could even drive it to Porkfest. And then it immediately went into the shop when it came back. So, you know, we're looking at this really in hard, realistic terms. Well, yesterday my wife and I went down and bought a brand new motorhome. And so that solves that problem. Now, I bring that up for a couple reasons. First off, it's, you know, we're pretty excited to have a brand new motorhome. But also because, you know, one of the things that we're considering, and we probably won't because of the distance involved, but one of the things that's kind of floating around in my mind is the possibility of going to Libertopia out in San Diego in a couple weeks. And like I said, that's probably out of the question. We're probably not going to do that because, you know, that's a long, hard drive. It's California. California is really not a safe place for someone like me. California has, and I'm saying this, you know, I was born in California. I lived a lot of years in California. And geographically speaking, environmentally speaking, you know, you think of the redwoods, you think of the sequoias, you think of the beautiful mountains and the wonderful coastline, and you think of the deserts and just the beauty of being, you know, it's not really describable to, unless you've experienced it, you really can't understand what it's like to lay in the middle of the desert on a, you know, on a, like on a lawn chair or something, and way out in the middle of the desert, miles and miles away from the nearest light, and look up and see the sky clear and filled with stars. It's just, you can't even begin to describe it in a way that does it duty. You know, it's just an unbelievable experience. So in many ways, I really love California, and I love going out there, and I have a lot of friends in California, and you know, there's a lot of stuff like that I could say, but the fact is the level of oppression that the government is at in California, I'm just not sure I can go to Libertopia in San Diego and take the risk of going through California to get there. So for whatever I may tease the idea, in all likelihood I won't go. I should mention, too, one of the motivations in today's podcast is I want to try to, I've been poking around with H.L. Mencken quotes, and so I wanted to feed in as many H.L. Mencken quotes into today's podcast as possible. So it might be, you know, I might name this podcast something like Let's Quote H.L. Mencken Day or something like that, but in back to, I just wanted to stick that in because when I start quoting H.L. Mencken, you'll know why. But back to the California thing, and you know, with Libertopia, it's Libertopia is really more of an indoor sport, so to speak. You know, it's in San Diego, it's in a convention center, it's all very well organized, and it looks like it'd be a lot of fun in many ways. But it's vastly different from what I went to at Porkfest. Porkfest, you know, is very free and open. It's in this giant campground. You can come and go as you please. There's all kinds of stuff going on. Some of it is, you know, authorized. Some of it is not authorized. Some of it's just spontaneous. And at any particular time at Porkfest, you can just, you know, you can just go hide. You can just disappear from everybody if you want to. And that's always very appealing to me, is the ability to just step away from all the noise and the crowds and everything. And that's not a reflection of, you know, I don't have anything against the people or anything like that. It's just that sometimes it's nice to just pull away and be by yourself and just think and relax and rest and not have, you know, not have to be, not have to have the show going at all times, so to speak, to not have to constantly be at your best and at your top, you know, your mind crisp and everything. Sometimes you just want to sit around and stare at the wall, you know? And you can't really, well, I don't know, I suppose you could do that at Libertopia if you hide in a hotel room, but that's no fun, you know? At least at Porkfest, you could just take off walking and get someplace where there's nobody else at in just a couple minutes. That's not real likely in San Diego. Although San Diego, on the positive side, San Diego has some killer restaurants. Anyway, one of the worst things, though, about going to Libertopia is that I'm going to have, if we go, and again, it's not likely I'll go, but if my wife and I decide to go, one of the things I'm going to have to deal with is that Libertopia is kind of a, well, I don't know how to say this and be polite. You know, I've talked before about the Liberty Movement allowing mimics in the garden, allowing people in and among us who really, if you examine what they're pushing, it's not libertarian at all. And yet we let them right in among us and we happily, you know, say, oh yeah, this guy's a libertarian. Now, I don't necessarily agree with everything he says, but he's a libertarian. Well, I don't know. You know, if we don't have some kind of standard to define these things, then how can we say someone is or isn't libertarian? And I'm not trying to be like Walter Block, where it's like, you know, Stefan Molyneux doesn't support Ron Paul, therefore Stefan Molyneux's not a libertarian. I'm not trying to be that way. But libertarian still has to have some kind of a definition. And if you wash that definition out so bad that anybody can be brought into to something called Libertopia and be a speaker, then, you know, what good does it really have? Does it really do to have a defining word to describe us if that word has no real meaning? And if you want to know specifically who or what I'm talking about, just take a look at the Libertopia lineup. You can just go to their website at libertopia.com, I think it is, I'm not sure. But go to Libertopia's website and look at the list of speakers. And you'll see that they're going to do a screening of the Thrive movie with Foster Gamble. Now, you know, somebody at some point has to stand up and point out the greenbackers. And I'm not hearing a lot of people in the libertarian movement doing this. As a matter of fact, so much of the Ron Paul crowd either are greenbackers or have are somewhat embracing the greenbacker ideas, or else they just don't know what it is, and you know, and there are wolves among them that they don't even understand are there. I'm not sure exactly why Ron Paul has failed to stand up and really clarify to people that he is not a greenbacker and he doesn't support these things. I don't know why he hasn't done that. He's had abundant opportunity, but sometimes it feels like, you know, sometimes it feels like me and Gary North and maybe one or two other people are the only ones really pointing out the greenbackers and saying, look, these people are among us and they're not one of us. They're deceivers. They're here to essentially rob and pillage and enslave us. But, you know, the message just seems to not get out. I'm going to give a real quick definition of a greenbacker. Again, I put a lot of emphasis on this last year, and I think I kind of beat the dead horse a little too much last year, so I don't want to do that this year. But it is fairly important for us, and I think because of that, sometimes we need to revisit it. A greenbacker, you know, they have levels of deception that they rely on in order to hook people into their trap. And one of the things that they rely on is their fanatical hatred of the Federal Reserve. Now, there's nothing wrong with hating the Federal Reserve. I hate to get robbed. I hate to have money stolen from me. I have no love of the Federal Reserve. I understand quite clearly that they are, a private banking organization, a private corporation, and that they've hoodwinked people into believing that they are either good or they're working with the government, or some people even believe they're part of the government. And I don't buy any of these things. I realize that the Federal Reserve is a private corporation and they are utilizing contracts with the government to rob us. I know this. I know these things. But the greenbackers will put great amounts of emphasis on this stuff, and then they will quietly offer you a deeper level of slavery as the solution. And they'll lie. The greenbackers will openly lie. Whether we're talking about, you know, I did a review of, or at least a partial review, of the greenbacker movie, The Secret of Oz. And I pointed out that in the first 15 minutes, I listened to something like 15 minutes and 38 seconds or something like that. I can't remember now. I'd have to look at my notes. And I believe it was something like, oh, I can't remember. let me just look real quick here. One moment, I'm going to pause. Okay, sorry for the interruption. I had to check my notes to make sure I said it correctly. So I listened to last year, actually I've watched the Secret of Oz movie a couple times. I went through it, if I recall, I went through it two times all the way through, and then I've started it several times. But for the review of it I did last year, I listened to the first 15 minutes and 38 seconds. In 15 minutes and 38 seconds, seven times they laid out the basic Greenbacker argument. And I point that out because people have told me, oh no, the Secret of Oz movie is not a Greenbacker movie. Well, first off, it's actually the people who did it are well-known Greenbackers. And like I started to say, seven times in the first 15 minutes, 38 seconds, the Greenbacker argument is laid out and presented as the solution to all of our problems. In that first 15 minutes and 38 seconds, in addition to the seven times the Greenbacker argument is laid out, there are 23 lies that I counted. Now, I'll give you an example. In the first 15 minutes or so, they claim that the Romans used fiat money and that it worked. Well, and specifically they're talking about copper and brass coinage. And they're claiming that the Romans used this copper and brass coinage and that it was fiat money. Well, that's entirely a deception and a lie. Copper and brass coins are commodities. They're not fiat. Commodities have value. Fiat has no value. Fiat only has the value that people believe that it has. That's where it gets the name fiat. It means, it's kind of like, it's an act of accepting in faith. It's kind of like saying amen, like I believe this, therefore it is so. That's what fiat is. It's an act of faith. So fiat money is not based on commodity. Fiat money is based on faith. But the Roman coins that were made of copper and brass were made of copper and brass. Copper and brass are commodities. They have value. They have intrinsic value, like gold, like silver, like any other commodity, like, you know, chicken feet. It doesn't matter. If it's a real commodity, then it has a value. But if the value is just believed upon it by your faith in whoever it is that's backing it, then it's a fiat currency. So in the movie The Secret of Oz, they openly lie over and over about these things. They twist and distort history, and they do it, it has to be intentional. Either it's intentional, or they're really stupid. There's really, I don't see a third option. They're either intentionally lying in the movie The Secret of Oz, or they're really, really dumb. And I have a hard time believing they're that dumb. I prefer believing that they're extremely dishonest. And you know, this is what we're dealing with, the Greenbackers. They tend to be really, really dishonest people. Now, they've deceived a lot of people, and a lot of their followers, especially the Ron Paul people who are deceived by them, a lot of those people have just never thought this thing through. And so they don't think about it, and they just accept it. And that's, well, that's just foolish. Here's the definition. I was going to give you a definition a minute ago. The definition of a greenbacker is a person who wants the government to issue fiat money. And they oftentimes they'll use the excuses of Federal Reserve and central banking being evil and credit expansion being evil. They like to really beat up credit in any way that they can. There's an almost fanatical hatred of anything credit among them. They have very little understanding of how credit actually works and what is, you know, in a free market situation, credit is simply purchasing money. If valuing money at a different time, here's a better way of looking at money. Let's say today I value a dollar, but I don't have a dollar. I value a dollar to a certain extent, and I'm willing to give up a dollar and a dime to have that dollar today, and I'll give you that dollar and a dime next year at this time. Well, that's not any kind of a ripoff. As long as everything is done above board and voluntarily, that's not a ripoff. That's just a difference in time preference. I would rather have the dollar now than a dollar and a dime a year from now. And you're looking at the situation and you're like, I'll give up a dollar now to have a dollar and a dime a year from now. So this is just a difference in the valuation and a difference in time preference. There's nothing immoral about that. So, but these greenbackers will tend to attack credit. They attempt to blend the ideas of credit with credit expansion, which is two different things altogether. And they try to tie these to evil central bankers. And they try to convince you that because we all agree that central banking is bad and credit expansion is bad, therefore we have to adopt all their ideas. And the core of their idea is that the government take over the means of production in the form of money. The government issues the money and backs it by its own faith, by faith in the government, and that's just fiat money. So you're just exchanging a fascist form of money exchange, which is what we have now with central banking. You're exchanging that for a socialist money exchange, which we would have under greenbacker banking. Well, why would you make a deal like that? Why would you reject fascism only to embrace socialism? Well, they have a deeper agenda. And like I said, they'll talk about taxes too. They'll say, well, all taxes could be eliminated, or they'll say taxes are bad, or taxes are robbery, or they'll say any of these other things that we all agree are correct and true. But then they offer fiat money as the answer, and what does fiat money do? Well, the government inflates the money, which is a hidden tax, and they can tax as much as they want. And we can't see it because inflation is a hidden tax. So it provides the government to tax us far more viciously than they ever could under any other form of taxation. And that's their solution. Well, that's just goofy. It's socialist is what it is. It's socialist in its core. The greenbacker ideology is based on socialism, the means of production. Whoever controls the means of production, let's put it this way. The central planning and the central control of the means of production is socialism. So if you have the number one means of production is money. So if you have the government controlling this money supply and centrally planning the money supply, you have socialism. So the greenbackers are socialists. And people who are fooled by them are fooled by socialists. Okay, I'm going to do a little less ranting when I get back from this commercial break, but I want to bring this back to Foster Gamble and Libertopia and Thrive and all these other things. I'll be right back. I'd like to talk to you about Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. The Liberty Classroom is a collection of courses on history and Austrian economics presented in an easy, convenient way. There are video files and audio files you can download. You can participate in discussions online in the discussion boards. And there are live sessions with Tom Woods and the other educators where you can directly interact with the instructors. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes that they didn't get the real story in government-approved schools. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers. Join Tom Woods and his team, and they'll equip you with one of the very best tools the Liberty Movement has to offer, knowledge, real knowledge in a usable form. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for only $99 a year. Now, that's less than the cost of one movie DVD a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site, all the courses plus additional courses that'll be added later, the discussion forums, the live sessions, everything. So how do you do this? You go to badquaker.com. You click on the banner for Tom Woods Liberty Classroom. By using that link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help badquaker.com. Thank you very much. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial there. And I should mention, I'm sorry to extend the commercial out longer than you already had to tolerate it, but I should mention that Tom Woods has added a new thing to his Liberty Classroom. He has a whole new section that they've added with a new teacher, or I should say instructor, and it's all on logic and logical argument. I just got a taste of it the other day. I haven't fully investigated it, but it looks like it's going to be really good. So if you've thought about the Tom Woods Liberty Classroom, it's not only history and some of the other things that they've advertised in the past. They now have a whole section of it on logic. So that's really cool. Okay, now So I was talking about, I was kind of slamming the Thrive movement and Foster Gamble. But I really think somebody needs to stand up to these greenbackers, because honestly, it's like I said, sometimes I feel like it's me and Gary North against the world, you know? And I don't even know Gary North. He didn't even know I exist. So, you know, we're just out there swinging in the dark with these people. And it really seems like sometimes, you know, and then I know that's not true, because I know other people I've read, like over at Daily Anarchist and some of the other locations where people are starting to really to point these people out for what they are. But, you know, sometimes it just seems like I'm all by myself out here. But I know I'm not. I'm just complaining now. But anyway, the idea that a greenbacker can be a libertarian, or that a libertarian can be a greenbacker, it's really self-contradicting. Because the core essence of libertarianism is the rejection of collectivism, the rejection of socialist ideas, the rejection that you know, that a government can use aggression and say, this is what money is and you have to accept it. And if you try to use anything else as money, we're going to arrest you. See, that's the opposite of libertarianism. And in all honesty, Foster Gamble, you go over to their Thrive website, and you see this weird hodgepodge, mishmash of really some, you know, a bunch of loonies. If you look around, there's contradicting things that are pushed there. So maybe Foster Gamble is not, you know, maybe Foster Gamble is honest. Maybe he's trying to do the best he can with, he's a very rich man, and he's got, you know, he has, I've heard him say before that he feels the obligation, because he has so much wealth, he feels the obligation to do something with it. So in his desperation to do good, he may be just very naively pumping money into projects that other people are feeding off of him and using him and using his money and his notability. And he's just not bright enough to understand that. You know, Foster Gamble comes from a leftist rich background where he never had to really think things through. Everything was always provided for him. And his whole outlook in his early years was driven by leftist liberal ideologies. So maybe, you know, maybe I'm too hard on Foster Gamble. Maybe he's just really, really naive and confused. But you know, a naive and confused gunman that's shooting into a crowd still needs to be dropped. He still needs to be taken out of there. And Foster Gamble, with all his money and all of his influence, he's allowing, you know, assuming he's naive and just silly and doesn't know any better, he's allowing these people to bring a very a polluting factor into the liberty movement. And when we, as libertarians, sit back and do nothing about this and let it happen, the newer libertarians coming in that don't really understand the distinguishing characteristics of these things, they just think, well, it's all part of the same club, I'll just accept all of it. And I think that's what happened with a lot of the Ron Paul people, because Ron Paul wasn't standing up and saying these greenbackers are wrong. Because he was kind of like saying, well, as long as we're all against the Fed, I guess it's all good. He didn't really say that, but that was kind of the inferred, you know, that was kind of inferred. And so people just accepted the greenbacker thing, not knowing that Ron Paul himself was against it. I really think Ron Paul could have clarified that and would have helped a lot. But, you know, getting back to what's wrong with the Thrive thing, well, here's one other thing that kind of that should cause any clear-thinking person to step back away from Thrive and step back away from people like Foster Gamble. You know, he's got this magic energy machine that he keeps talking about, and he doesn't show it to anybody. He doesn't actually, you know, produce one, but he keeps proclaiming that they have this magic energy machine and that all they have to do is turn it on and start making free energy for everybody. But somehow the evil people are keeping it from happening. But he's seen it. He's seen it happen. Well, again, he's either a fool or he thinks we're fools, one or the other, because there is no magic energy machine. I'm pretty sure about, well, maybe not. I started to say an eighth grade science class ought to be able to debunk that. But then again, I think about how horrible, you know, public schools are, maybe not. Maybe that's why people believe there's a magic energy machine. But Foster Gamble should know better than this. Having the kind of education and upbringing he had, he should know better than to support magic energy machines. But, you know, and then he pushes these, what he calls a fair election. That's part of the Thrive thing, too, is to have a fair election. Now I get to quote H.L. Mencken here. The urge to save humanity is almost always only a false face for the urge to rule it. And, you know, when you start seeing whatever website it is, in this case it's Thrive, but it could be Downsize DC or anybody else, and they start saying, oh, all we have to do is just do this, and we'll get government to restrict itself. We'll get government to limit itself. Government has done so well at regulating itself, hasn't it? Yeah, government will voluntarily, they'll voluntarily limit themselves. All we have to do is urge them. Government will volunteer to crush their own monopoly, right? That's what they'll do, huh? If we just send them letters, maybe, or call their offices, that'll set them right as rain, right? All we got to do is just send them emails or sign a petition, and government will be good, right? Can we really accept this among us as a logical alternative? In how many years, 230-some years, that people have been urging the U.S. government to behave itself? And all it does is just slip further and further into evil, into despotism? Why would we think that simply asking government politely to do what we want it to do is somehow going to work? That somehow those people in government who are, you know, who are doing everything that they're doing on a daily basis are suddenly going to have a Homer Simpson moment and go, "Doh!" And then turn themselves around and start doing everything good. Why would we believe that? That's about as naive as thinking we have a magic energy machine. But if you go over there to Thrive, that's one of to their website, that's one of the things. They have this Fair Election Now bill, which is supported by 4 members of Congress, and they're trying to push it through Congress. Fair Election Now bill. That's like trusting alligators to pass a law that protects fish. I mean, these guys are the people. These are the people that are right in there doing this stuff. And we're going to trust them to write a bill that will somehow limit how they spend money to get elected, and it won't come out for them, better off for them? How can a person believe that the very thieves that are robbing us, that if we ask them politely, that they'll figure out a way to rob us, you know, less violently, or rob us in a more polite way, or even that they'll lower the amount that they're robbing us, or that they'll somehow, you know, stop robbing us and switch and bring only good people into government. How do people accept this kind of nonsense? This kind of faith-based government is just, it's amazing. So getting back to Libertopia. You know, and there they have him as one of the speakers. I don't know. You know, I'm not real good at confrontations because, you know, I tend to raise my voice and I tend to use my physical presence a little bit more than I should when there's a confrontation. And this is a confrontation between people like the Thrive, like, you know, people like that, or whether we're talking about Venus Project or any of these other socialist groups that try to infiltrate the libertarian group, the liberty movement. I tend to not be all that polite when I have to confront these people, and so I'm probably not the best to go to Libertopia and sit there through the screening of the movie Thrive and then do the question answer thing and then start pointing out the socialism that the guy is pushing or point out the absolute nonsense of perpetual motion machines and free energy and all these nonsense. I'm not the right guy to do that, so you know, I'd have to stay away from that part of it even if we went to Libertopia. But again, who'll stand up to these people in the liberty movement? Who is there that's left that'll stand up to these people and point out socialism, point out the collectivist pollution that's coming in upon us. If you go over, and if you want more evidence of this with Thrive, if you go over to their website and hover your mouse over where it says 12 sectors, and then click on the one that says economics. Now, the first two sections of the page are simply first stage brainwashing. That's all that is. With brainwashing, the first thing that you want to do is you want to convince the person that the handler is on their side. Once you lower their skeptical defenses, then the mind control can begin. So when you look at that Thrive website on economics, you have to scroll past those first two sections, because those are just a first stage brainwashing. They're just there to lower your defenses and get you to think that your handlers are working for you and working on your side. So just ignore that, because it's lies, it's blather. And then you get down to where the videos are listed, and you see all these video clips with these different people. And the one thing you don't see is a single Austrian economist. That's what's not in the video clips. Let me back up just for a second, because I meant to bring up something when I was talking about that first stage brainwashing. What the brainwashing person wants to do for you is he first wants to convince you of something you already believe to be true. And by doing that, he breaks down this barrier in your mind so that you feel like you're already on the same side as this person. He's already on your team. You don't have to question him, because you've already got common ground. So an example of this is, let's say I tell you, well, grass is green. Well, you agree with that. Sure, grass is green. Uh-huh. And without water, grass turns brown and dies. Well, sure, you know that. Yeah, without water, grass would die. It turns brown. Well, you know, without water, humans die. Sure, I believe that. Yeah, without water, humans die. So death is not good. Grass, dead grass is no good. I don't want to die. Do you want to die? No, I don't want to die. Yeah, so green is good and brown is bad. We should use aggression to destroy everything that's brown. What? You see, this is a non sequitur, or a different way of saying it. It doesn't follow. Okay, so grass is green, sure. Without water, grass turns brown. Yeah, and dies. Uh-huh, sure it does. And without water, humans die, right? Yeah, yeah, uh-huh. So green is good and brown is bad, and we should use aggression to destroy everything that's brown. Well, no, the mind, that takes a huge leap. Why would we think that? Well, the reason why we would think that is because that's the way that we're being brainwashed to think in this scenario that I'm putting together for you. But it's a non sequitur. You don't have to follow. There's no logical reason to go from one of those things to the other. There's no connection. But that's what the brainwasher wants you to do. He gets you to believe something that you already believe. You lower your defenses, and then he gives you something new to believe that's not true. But because you've already put yourself into a position where you're believing what he's telling you, you just accept the non-believable part. There's a commercial on TV for, I believe it's for some kind of satellite TV company, and they want you to not use cable. So they use a series of non sequiturs, and I've got the wording here for it, and of course I can't paint the imagery for you, but it says, when you wait forever for the cable guy, you get bored. When you get bored, you start to stare out the windows. When you start staring out windows, you see things you shouldn't see. When you see things you shouldn't see, you need to vanish. When you need to vanish, you need to fake your own death. When you fake your own death, you dye your eyebrows. When you dye your eyebrows, you attend your own funeral as a guy named Phil Schifley. Don't attend your own funeral as a guy named Phil Schifley. And then as it's saying, this is the voiceover saying these things, as it's saying them, it shows the imagery of a guy sitting there being bored, then looking out the window, and he sees what appears to be two guys putting a body into the trunk of a car. And so he has to disappear. And then he ends up dyeing his eyebrows and attending his own funeral. So the inference is that if you wait for the cable guy rather than just getting their satellite service, if you wait for the cable guy, you're going to have to change your identity and run for your life and change into a guy named Phil Schifley. You see, it's a non sequitur. The one thing doesn't follow the other. Now, when I get back, I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about Greenbackers and some of the problems with the Thrive and their website and some of the fallacies that they're based on. Stick with me. I'll be right back. BadQuaker.com uses HostGator as our web hosting service. It was fast and easy to get set up, and the support we receive is top-notch. They have helpful and friendly 24/7, 365 live technical support and a 99.9% uptime guarantee, and they have some of the best prices in the business. If you have a website, or if you want to have a website, check them out by going to BadQuaker.com and click on the button for HostGator. And thank you very much for supporting BadQuaker.com.
Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz.
First rule of being alive is you own yourself.
A groundbreaking approach to firearms and self-defense training. Beautifully filmed and easy to understand instructions make this one a must-have. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. New DVD from Michael W. Dean. Available on Amazon. Your house is your
property. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. And I want to mention, in that commercial you just heard, there was a commercial for, or in that break you just heard, there was a commercial for Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle. This is a new movie that's been put out by Michael W. Dean. And of course, as many of you, you know, if you're a regular listener, you know that Michael W. Dean is a personal friend of mine. And he's a fellow podcaster. He has the Freedom Fiends podcast. He has the Gumbo, the Anarchy Gumbo podcast. And he does a couple other things. And so, you know, I do a commercial for him. Because he's my friend, but also I've watched this movie, and it's really good. It is well worth your time to watch it. It makes some, even if you're, you know, if you're an experienced gun handler, and you think, well, I don't need that because it's this particular one is Volume 1, Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz. Well, you think, I don't need that. I've been handling a gun for years, and blah blah blah. Even if you're a really good gun handler, you're going to find stuff in this video that you're going to learn from, and because it comes at different angles with things, and it applies the non-aggression principle, and it really they really do a good job of it. Plus, it's just fun to watch. But even if you if you're not a seasoned gun handler, then there's really good stuff in it. There's good stuff about grip, and there's good stuff about safety, and it's just a really good video. I strongly recommend it. Not just because Michael's my friend, but because I watched it, I really enjoyed it. I'm going to have my family watch it. That's how much I like this movie. Okay, now getting back to the Thrive people. If you're on their website and you go to the economics part, like I said, and you scroll down past the brainwashing to the video clips, you find absolutely zero Austrian economists. There is no hint of Austrian economics anywhere on their site that I have found. I have seen where Foster Grant has come onto other shows, onto other podcasts, and come onto other websites and done interviews and so forth. And he name drops Murray Rothbard and Ludwig von Mises and stuff, but nothing on their website. It relates in any way to Austrian economics, and nothing they say relates to Austrian economics. They name drop again. They name drop, but that's all they do. They just name drop. They don't actually show any indication of having any knowledge of Austrian economics. Very much like Gary Johnson, the so-called libertarian presidential candidate, no idea of libertarian of Austrian economics. Yet he's more than willing to name drop. Okay, so as you scroll down, you don't see any Austrians. You see extremist leftists, and you see extremist rightists, and you see greenbackers. Like Bill Still is one of the main guys, and of course Bill Still is one of the leading people in the greenbacker movement. So he's a socialist. And then you've got Paul Hawken in there. He's a leftist, socialist, environmental nut who wants to have carbon credits and do all this other crazy stuff. That's not libertarian. That Van Johnson, the leftist socialist activist, Van Johnson? Come on. How can we even toy with the idea that Van Johnson is somehow going to be useful to a libertarian. Ed Griffin, well, there's a weird case for you. You know, when it comes to Ed Griffin, I guess the old saying, a broken watch is right twice a day. I guess you could say that about Ed Griffin. He wrote that book, what was it, from Jekyll Island, the monster from Jekyll Island, or the whatever it was. I can't remember. It's been a long time. But Ed Griffin is a hard right-wing John Birch Society, former speechwriter for the racist right-wing George Wallace campaign back in the 60s. He's the guy that keeps rediscovering Noah's Ark and then quietly drops the topic when his discoveries are debunked. And he's the guy who suddenly became a libertarian in 2002 and put together a libertarian organization that we're all supposed to embrace. But if you go over to Wiki, if you read the Wiki page on him, Griffin says that collectivism and freedom are mortal enemies. Yeah, that's interesting. That reminded me of a H.L. Mencken quote, actually, but I'll get to that in a minute. So Griffin says that collectivism and freedom are mortal enemies. And he says that one of his goals is to elect people with the same view to government offices and on to boards of nonprofit organizations. It says his motto is, don't fight City Hall when you can be City Hall. This is interesting. I'm going to do that one more time. I'm going to read that again. Don't fight City Hall when you can be City Hall. And one of his goals is to elect people with the same view of government into offices and into the boards of nonprofit organizations. So he says collectivism and freedom are mortal enemies, but we should collectively elect people into offices. Don't fight City Hall, but we can be City Hall. That reminded me of a Lord of the Rings reference where, let's see, how did Gollum say the exact same concept? I think Gollum said something like, and then we take the precious and we be the master. Yeah, but there was a good guy too, Boromir. There was a good guy who wanted the Ring of Power. And Boromir's approach was different. He says this to Frodo, but if you would but lend me the ring, yeah, I'd do good with it, see? If you just lend me the ring, I'll do good with it. I'll be the master. But there was in the same story, there's the good and wise old Gandalf. And Gandalf says, when Frodo tries to hand him the ring, Gandalf says, don't tempt me, Frodo. I dare not take it, not even to keep it safe. Understand, Frodo, I would use this ring from a desire to do good, but through me it would wield power too great and terrible to imagine. You see, in the weakest hands, power corrupts and devours the holder of the ring. But in the powerful and good hands, the ring becomes unimaginably destructive. Let's go back to H.L. Mencken. H.L. Mencken said, liberty and democracy are eternal enemies, and everyone knows it who has ever given any sober reflections to the matter. Liberty and democracy are eternal enemies. Now, how was it that Griffin says it? Collectivism and freedom are mortal enemies? Well, I wouldn't call it plagiarism, because I misquote Murray Rothbard a lot, and other people too, so I suppose it's all fair game. But the concept is the same, no matter whether you want to use the words collectivism and freedom or liberty and democracy. Either way, collectivism is democracy, democracy is collectivism. And to use the force of government, you know, government is collectivism. That's what it is. And when you use government to accomplish your goals, is it possible to create liberty, to create freedom? Of course it's not. And like H.L. Mencken said, everyone who's ever given this any sober reflection understands this. So if we can agree that collectivism and freedom are mortal enemies, if we can agree that democracy and liberty are eternal enemies, then why do we want the Ring of Power? Why do we want to not fight Central City Hall, but go and be a part of, to actually be City Hall? Why would we want to do that? What kind of a person wants to be in charge of other people and wants to lord their will upon other people. You see, Libertopia exposes the weakness that I've been talking about in the liberty movement. Ed Griffin says collectivism and freedom are moral enemies. Why do these people insist on using collectivism as a means of achieving liberty? Elections have never worked. I said it a second ago, 230 years of sliding deeper into despotism. And the only solution these people can offer is give the ring to a different golem? Is that the only thing we can come up with after 230 years of repeating the same process over and over? Yeah, let's just pick a new golem and give him the ring. That'll be great. Let's go back to Mencken again. The kind of man who wants the government to adopt and enforce his ideas is always the kind of man whose ideas are idiotic. I didn't call anybody an idiot, but H.L. Mencken did. The kind of man who wants the government to adopt and enforce his ideas is always the kind of man whose ideas are idiotic. We have to learn from past mistakes, folks. H.L. Mencken lived quite some time back. This stuff has all been out there, you know, right along. Now, of course, with the internet, we get the spread of information. People get to hear the words of H.L. Mencken who've never heard him before. But you have to break these things down to their core. When somebody starts telling you we have to end the Fed, and then you think about, well, what is the Fed? The Fed is a private corporation. Okay, so you want the government to take action against a private corporation. Because you decided that the Fed is bad, but Monsanto's bad, and lots of other companies are bad. So is your solution to have the government go after them and regulate them and audit them and take them apart and disassemble them? Is that the libertarian view of what should be done to fix things? The government should take aggressive action against private corporations? Is that libertarian? Or is that using collectivism to accomplish what you want? Just give you the ring, right? You're a good person. If we give you the ring, you'll do the right thing, right? I think one of the problems we have among all of us in the whole liberty movement is that so many of us have adopted this open arms, this Big Ten approach to liberty, and it's never worked in the past. Back to H.L. Mencken, he said, we must respect the other fellow's religion, but only in the sense and to the extent that we respect his theory that his wife is beautiful and his children are smart. You see, everybody's wife can't be beautiful and everybody's children are not smart. But if you talk to a father, if you talk to a husband who loves his wife's beautiful and his children are brilliant. But are they really? In his eyes, they are. And we should respect his opinion to the extent that we understand where he's coming from with this. So yeah, we can have open arms and a Big Ten approach, only to the point of where we have to face reality and say, look, you're pushing socialism here. You want to audit the Fed? Great. Except you're going to use the violence of government to do that with. How about if we don't? How about if we let the market fix the Fed? How about if we let the market fix government? How about if we let the market? How about if we trust in the market instead of the government? And this learning from history thing, the libertarians failed to learn this when they tied themselves in with the Republicans in the Goldwater days in the mid-60s. The libertarians didn't learn their lesson then. Goldwater smacked the Republicans pretty hard right across the face, and libertarians didn't learn. And so they tried to snuggle up to the liberals in the late 60s and the early 70s, and they got smacked right in the face. They didn't learn. And then, Ronald Reagan came along in 1980, and the libertarian herds willingly were fooled by Ronald Reagan. I allowed myself to be fooled by Ronald Reagan. And we got smacked right square across the face again. How many more times? libertarians got all excited about the contract with America in the 90s. Yeah, I know, we all recognize that Newt Gingrich and his form of Republicans were a little greasy. We could see that, but we were really excited about these words about reducing the size and the scope of government. And all these words were so appealing, and we got really excited about the contract with America. And then the Republicans just slapped us right across the face and laughed. And then the libertarians got all excited about the Tea Party. Oh, the Tea Party. Yeah, we're going to limit government. We're going to cut taxes. We're going to do all these great things with the Tea Party. And then what happened? The Republicans slapped us right across the face and laughed at us, mocked us publicly. That's what they do. How many more times? How many more times are you going to treat me the way you want to do? So we had these presidential debates last night, and I intentionally didn't watch him. I had no desire to watch. Why would I want to watch the presidential debate? Clown 1 against Clown 2? Or even if they would have let Gary Johnson Clown 3 in on it, how could they have possibly said anything interesting? What two socialists arm wrestling? Is that what, you know, where's the difference? I was talking to a Republican here recently, and he was trying to explain to me that, yes, I know that Romney's not all that great, but if Obama goes back in for another 4 years, all kinds of destruction. And he starts telling me how the inner cities are going to fall apart, and we're going to have violence in the streets and all these things that they've been, you know. Well, I don't know, maybe, yeah, it's happening in Europe at times. It'll happen here eventually. There will be violence, sure. I mean, that's what humans do. When governments start to fail, humans get violent. This is fairly predictable. But, you know, here's the two things that take place in these presidential elections. We have a kind of two ways of thinking. We have this hero worship, whether we're talking about hero worship of Ron Paul, or we're talking about a hero worship of Barack Obama, or back in the George Bush days, there was quite a bit of hero worship with him, or, you know, Ronald Reagan, whoever, doesn't matter. You have this illogical hero worship where you deeply believe that this guy is going to do all these wonderful things, and this guy is going to be the man who's going to save us all, and this great man, he's going to go into government, and he's going to fix everything. And then you have the flip side of that. The flip side is to believe that the other guy is some kind of a demon or a monster. So it's always either the hero worship that motivates these voters, or it's the fear of the demon that motivates the voters. Yeah, I realize, you know, that maybe Romney's not the greatest choice, but, oh, we have to keep Obama out. Oh, Obama will destroy everything. Well, you know, the same trick gets pulled over and over and over, and voters buy it over and over and over, and they just oscillate from one to the other, worshiping their hero or fearing the demon, worshiping the hero and fearing the demon. And they never realize that they're just being played. It's just a, you know, they're a fiddle and a tune is being played, and they just never see it. H.L. Mencken said, "The whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace in a continual state of alarm, and hence clamorous to be led to safety, by menacing them with an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary." An endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary. So whether we're talking about imaginary terrorists that are popping up behind every rock, trying to, you know, turning every backpack into a bomb, and anything that's not a flag must be a bomb, and anything that we see, oh, there's an abandoned little piece of abandoned paper bag on the street, it must be a bomb, we better call the bomb crew. Oh, we've got to see something, say something. We've got to have brainwashing in Walmart with the Homeland Security videos telling us that, you know, watch your neighbor, turn in anybody who's suspicious. We have to constantly be in a state of fear for the government to control us. And the same thing goes with elections. We have to go vote. We have to go vote. If you don't vote for Romney, you're voting for Obama. No, you're an idiot. That doesn't, you know, that's going back to what I was talking about, brainwashing earlier. they start out saying something that makes sense to you, and then they get to the point of where you've lowered your defenses, and then they insert some slogan that makes no sense whatsoever. And without realizing it, you buy it. And then you start repeating the slogan. And the next thing you know, you're saying, well, if you don't vote, you don't have the right to complain. Really? Complaining is talking. I don't have the right to talk. I don't have the right to speak. My right of speech is limited as to whether or not I go vote. Is that what you're saying? You see, these things fall apart as soon as you analyze them. No, the very fact that I didn't vote means I have the right to speak about it. If I went out and involved myself in that process, then I've already spoken, haven't I? But if I don't involve myself in that dirty, filthy process, then I have the right to say it's a dirty, filthy process and I'll have nothing to do with it. I will not use the violence of government to try to accomplish my will. I will not try to push my will upon other people by way of the violence of government. I'm not going to do that. And I'm not going to be afraid of hobgoblins. And I'm not going to say, oh, I better go vote for this lesser of evils so we don't get stuck with that horrible one over there because he's so bad. And I don't go thinking that some great man is going to save me from all the bad things in life. No, I keep my hands clean. And I walk away from the whole process. And I say, you fooled me before. Shame on you. But you're never going to fool me again. I won't be fooled again. Folks, for more on liberty, property rights, and the zero aggression principle, go to badquaker.com. And don't be fooled again.